There was significant growth in evangelicalism during the 20th century, but under the surface, trouble was brewing.
In the 1970s, a number of key evangelical leaders, including R.C. Sproul and James Montgomery Boyce and J.I. Packer, looked around and said, in our own evangelical movement, we are beginning to see slippage on the doctrine of Scripture.
You know, no one comes right out and says they want to see error creep into the church. That's probably not the goal of any church leader. But when our focus is on success and growth, we tend to take our eye off the main thing, the fundamental doctrines of the faith. The 20th century is full of disappointing examples of this, but thankfully we see inspiring examples of people who stood for biblical truth, including our founder, Dr. R.C. Sproul. Here's Ligonier Teaching Fellow, Dr. Robert Gottfried.
We want to return now to the subject of evangelicalism. When we began early on talking about tensions within American Protestantism in the early 20th century, I argued that increasingly the word evangelical fell into disuse because everybody claimed to be an evangelical. And so the word didn't really have much meaning anymore. And as a result, people got labeled much more frequently modernists or fundamentalists. And that was even more powerfully true in the 1920s and in the 1930s. But after the Second World War, and very often after a war, there's a whole new period of peaceableness, of desire for unity, of reevaluation of relationships. In the late 1940s, a prominent Protestant leader began to argue that we really ought to revive the word evangelical. And that leader was Carl Henry, a man who would have a very profound impact on American Protestantism, conservative American Protestantism, for a number of decades. He wrote in 1947 a book called The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. Notice he still is using the phrase fundamentalist to describe himself. He's not embarrassed, but he says in this book, I recognize now that the word fundamentalist has taken on some negative connotations, and maybe some of that negativity is deserved. And he said, it seems to me that we as fundamentalists have become too withdrawn from the nation, from the general cultural development of the period in which we live. We need to be more engaged. And secondly, he said, I think we've become too individualistic in our approach to Christianity. We have so stressed the importance of individual conversion that we haven't really thought enough about the church and about the community of Christians. And thirdly, he said, we have almost entirely backed away from concern about social issues and just talked about private morality. We talked in the previous series about how many social issues were addressed in rather progressive ways by conservative Protestants in the 19th century. And as we come into the 20th century, there continued to be social concern early in the century. The last great battle was for prohibition. That was the great conservative Protestant cause. If we can only get rid of demon rum, we'll remake the country. It didn't work out so well, as it turned out. But that was a great moral crusade. And it was a moral crusade not just in the name of individual piety, but it was a crusade in the name of social improvement for the poor who were spending too much on alcohol and so forth. And Henry is saying, we need to recapture some of that social vision as well as a church vision and engage with the world around us. In 1948, the very next year, he began a series of articles in a Christian magazine that had the title, The Vigor of the New Evangelicalism. And it's at that point that Henry begins to suggest that evangelical maybe will be a more positive word, a more forward-looking word. It's an old word. It's a venerable word. And maybe we need to revive it in light of the negative connotations of the word fundamentalist. And through the work of Henry and others who began to associate themselves with him, there emerged a whole series of new leaders and new institutions and new avenues for advancing the cause of the new evangelicalism. And one of the early and very important figures in that development was Billy Graham. It was Billy Graham that first came to fame during his Los Angeles crusade in 1949. And the famous story is that on a slow news day, William Randolph Hearst sent his reporters to the Billy Graham crusade with the instructions, "Puff Graham, give him publicity." And so Billy Graham began to be covered, began to be more influential, and began to be the sort of model of what the new evangelicalism was all about. Passionate, commitment, vigorous, and committed to involving the conservative Protestant cause in the world. Somebody once asked a scholar, "Can you give me a brief definition of evangelical?" And he thought a minute and said, "Someone who likes Billy Graham." Or alternatively, someone who thinks that the Apostle Paul was Billy Graham with a Greek accent. That's the sort of notion that Billy Graham became such a leader. And of course, Billy Graham, as he emerged, then seemed to be part of that apostolic succession that I talked about of evangelists. George Whitfield, Charles Grandison Finney, Dwight L. Moody, Billy Sunday, maybe Amy Semple McPherson, and then Billy Graham. So he emerges as a very prominent voice on the scene. At just about the same time, in 1947, Fuller Theological Seminary held its first classes. And it, too, was dedicated to being a voice of this new evangelical movement. The founders of Fuller Seminary, that included Carl Henry and Dr. Akinge, long pastor of Park Street Church in Boston, and others, they said, "We want a really first-rate academic seminary, like Westminster Seminary, but not so narrowly reformed. We want to be broadly reformed." That was part of the new evangelicalism. And Fuller Seminary came to represent that and to be one of its key institutions for a while. Then Carl Henry said, "We really need a magazine." Henry's background was in journalism. And he said, "We need a magazine to carry this forward." And he founded Christianity Today in 1955. And if you go back and look at the old Christianity Today, it wasn't a news magazine. It was a fairly serious theological journal. And the very prominent theological leaders of the Protestant world, the conservative Protestant world, wrote in that journal. Now, it was not a scholarly journal for scholars, but it was bringing first-rate scholars to try to write about key issues that would speak to ministers and to lay people. So it was really pretty tony. It was pretty high level as a theological accomplishment. And then other institutions began to be formed. The National Association of Evangelicals was formed to try to bring a variety of emerging denominations, educational institutions, a variety of different things together to have a kind of united voice. They also founded the Evangelical Theological Society, which was to be a meeting place for evangelical scholars from colleges and universities and seminaries from all over the world. In a lot of ways, we could say the foundations of Campus Crusade by Bill Bright were a similar manifestation of something of this new spirit, wanting to communicate unity, love, and respectability. Those were some of the key concerns of the new evangelicalism. They didn't want to abandon the faith, but they wanted a kind of new engagement. One of the really controversial moments of that new engagement was the decision of Billy Graham in 1956 to begin to cooperate with liberal ministers. This was a very controversial move on his part at that time. You know how Billy Graham when he moved into a city, he would get as many ministers as he could to cooperate in supporting the crusade. Those ministers would often appear on the platform with him, sitting behind him as if to demonstrate their support of the crusade. And then the crusade would gather the names of all the people who came forward at a meeting, and any of them who identified a church affiliation, the crusade would write to that church and say, so-and-so from your church came forward, you should follow up. And the crusade would urge those people to go back to their churches. Well, until 1956, Billy Graham only cooperated with conservative Protestant ministers and conservative Protestant churches, and only sent people to those conservative Protestant churches. But in 1956, he changed his strategy and began to cooperate with modernist ministers as well as conservative ministers. Well, the old fundamentalist support, the strict fundamentalist support, exploded about that. And Billy Graham was subjected to all kinds of criticism. But as it turns out, the critics found themselves to be a smaller part of the new evangelicalism than they had expected. And while not everyone was happy about it, many sort of understood Billy Graham's theory that this would increase his influence. Now, I've always been tempted to write a book. I've actually told R.C. Sproul he ought to write this book because he actually writes books. I only write titles and outlines of books. We need a book called The Myth of Influence, because through the whole history of the church, it's fascinating how many things have been done that were bad in the name of being more influential. Whereas, in fact, almost always in the history of the church, the people who have actually been influential didn't set out to be influential, but set out to be faithful. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that. There's a book for one of you to write. There's no doubt that Billy Graham got many more people cooperating with him than he would have had otherwise. It vastly contributed to his respectability. It would have been relatively easy to say, well, you know, Billy Graham, he's a Southerner, not too well educated, just another of those knucklehead fundamentalists. But his cooperative spirit led to much better press coverage for Billy Graham and did in some ways increase his influence. The 1960s, of course, in America were a turbulent period. They were a period in which some of the evangelicals were uncertain as to how to relate to broader cultural movements. Certainly, it was a critical period in the history of the black churches as movements were being undertaken to claim civil rights, extend voting rights, allow blacks to take a much more protected legal place in American society. And there's no doubt that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. regularly advanced his cause in the name of Christianity. And whatever we may think about Dr. King's personal theology, I think in looking back, we have to say it's an amazing thing that that movement remained a nonviolent movement. And it remained a nonviolent movement because Dr. King over and over again said, that's the Christian thing to do. And we ought to recognize that as a remarkable achievement in the history of our nation. Interestingly enough, as we come out of the turbulent 60s, suddenly America discovers the evangelicals. A great church historian, Martin Marty, at the University of Chicago in 1976, discovered the evangelicals. I don't know where we'd all been, but suddenly we had come out into the light and made it on the cover of Time magazine. And whether we like it or not, Jimmy Carter helped with that because of his rather straightforward commitments of faith. And then as we move on into the 80s with Ronald Reagan and some of the light he shined on the evangelical movement, suddenly evangelicalism had accomplished what it had so long hoped to accomplish from the days of Henry. It had become noticed. It had become respectable. It had become somewhat influential. Suddenly, in national elections, people were talking about the evangelical vote. We'd long heard about the Catholic vote and the black vote and different voting blocks. Suddenly, evangelicals were being counted as one of those voting blocks. And so, in some ways, it seemed that evangelicals were doing so well, they might need to go back to their old postmillennial eschatology. That never happened, actually, but And yet at the very time that these successes were taking place, there were internal tensions manifesting themselves theologically in the movement. And one of the interesting points at which that manifested itself was in the 1970s, a number of key evangelical leaders, including R.C. Sproul and James Montgomery Boyce and J.I. Packer, looked around and said, in our own evangelical movement, we are beginning to see slippage on the doctrine of Scripture. Despite our experience early in the century, now again, this problem of the authority of Scripture is coming up. And those leaders gathered in Chicago to adopt a statement of faith and to organize something called the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy. And they said, we need to recommit ourselves to the inerrancy of Scripture and to use that word to insist on the complete reliability and infallibility of Scripture. Now, there were people, you see, who were saying, well, I believe in the infallibility of Scripture. I believe in the trustworthiness of Scripture. I believe in the authority of Scripture. It's just that I think there are some errors in the Bible. And the leaders of the evangelical movement said, this really won't do. This is a slippery slope. We've been this path before. Let's not go there again. I actually attended those meetings in Chicago. I think I was in third grade. Well, maybe not. I attended those meetings in Chicago, and I can vividly remember J.I. Packer giving an address in which he said, inerrancy as a word must be for us the shibboleth of our time. I hope you all know the book of Judges well enough to know that when Israel was battling the Ephraimites, the way they spotted those sneaky Ephraimites was that the Ephraimites couldn't say shibboleth. They could only say sibboleth. And so they were revealed for who they were. And I think Packer was making a very good point. Sometimes you need a word. At the Council of Nicaea, they needed the word homoousios, of the same substance, to clarify the relationship of the eternal Son to the eternal Father. And I think these fathers in the faith were absolutely right that we needed this word inerrancy. If you have trouble with the word inerrancy, maybe we need to take a second look at you. Maybe the trouble is not with the word, but with you. And this movement was not just to create a statement and an organization, but out of that came many volumes of scholarly work defending that inerrancy is what the Bible teaches about itself, that inerrancy is what the church has always believed about the Bible, not just the Protestant church, but the Roman church in the ancient period and the medieval period, the Eastern Orthodox churches. And it was a huge scholarly as well as popular accomplishment that really stabilized the movement for a time. And it was a very impressive achievement. And yet today, we find exactly those same problems arising again. It was very interesting to be at the Ligonier National Conference this year. Some of you may have been there. And to hear Rosario Butterfield talk about her experience of the change of her life from being a university professor of English, a secularist, and a lesbian, to becoming a Christian, a married woman with children. She's a lovely person, a kind person. She's not confrontational and mean-spirited in any way. And she was talking about going to many different places to speak. And she had one of the troubling things has been to go to Christian colleges. Christian colleges that have a relatively conservative reputation and find visceral opposition to her being there and to her bearing testimony just to her own experience. She's not out there sort of claiming anything other than wanting to tell the story of what Christ did for her. And yet the opposition in Sometimes faculties and in student bodies in Christian institutions suggest that the evangelical cause is in some danger today. I don't think it's too much to say that here at the beginning of the 21st century, we're in almost an identical position as to where evangelicalism was at the end of the 19th century. Namely, we have a label, but it's a label covering very broadly different theological convictions. And what I, as a historian, am somewhat alarmed about is that it doesn't seem to me that we're heading towards any explosion of the kind we saw in the 1920s. And I worry that instead of an explosion, we may be facing an evangelical evaporation. Who's going to stand up and say they really care about this situation? Who's going to defend the historic Protestant conservative view? Is evangelicalism enough? That may resonate in your mind with a book title that was written by Thomas Howard some years ago now, entitled Evangelical Is Not Enough. Now, Thomas Howard was a son of a very prominent American evangelical family. His brother, David Howard, served as president of the World Evangelical Fellowship, a conservative worldwide evangelical organization. His sister was famous as Elizabeth Elliot, whose husband was martyred as a missionary in Peru. And Thomas Howard was a professor of English at Gordon College, conservative Protestant college, and he wrote this book, Evangelical Is Not Enough, to say that I don't find evangelicalism satisfying anymore. It's not enough. It's fine as far as it goes. It's not that I really don't believe most of the things evangelicals believe, but it's not enough. And Thomas Howard became a Roman Catholic. Now, I don't think we can at all say that there's been a flood out of evangelical circles into Roman Catholicism. But there has been enough prominent movement that maybe we should pause and reflect. Francis Schaeffer's son, Frankie Schaeffer, became Eastern Orthodox. Some leaders of Campus Crusade became Eastern Orthodox. John Richard Newhouse, a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor, became Roman Catholic. And we have to ask ourselves, what is sort of going on here? Why this dissatisfaction? We're going to do that in another lecture. We need to begin to reflect what's going on with evangelicalism, what's the character of evangelicalism. Is there some structural deficiency in evangelicalism that has left it being somewhat unstable at the end of the 19th century and now finding it somewhat unstable again at the end of the 20th century?
That's Dr. Robert Godfrey with a lesson from his Sweeping Church History series. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Wednesday. Thank you for joining us. I'm Lee Webb. Unfortunately, today, many are unfamiliar with church history, and because of that, we're missing the thread of God's faithfulness over the centuries. Let me encourage you to request Part 6 of Dr. Godfrey's series. It covers the entire 20th century in 12 messages. The decisions made 100 years ago truly affect our lives today. So we'd like to send you the 2-DVD set. Simply contact us today and request it with your donation of any amount. You can call us at 800-435-4343, or you can go online to renewingyourmind.org. While we've witnessed faithful leaders in the church, we've also seen, unfortunately, how biblical illiteracy and a loose grip on theology have combined to weaken the church. Studying church history helps us understand how we got here and, more importantly, how we can correct our course. Again, contact us today with your gift of any amount, and we will send you Dr. Godfrey's 12 messages on the most recent chapter of church history, the 20th century. Our web address is renewingyourmind.org and our phone number 800-435-4343. Dr. Godfrey, along with our other Ligonier teaching fellows, are also featured regularly on RefNet. That's our 24-hour internet radio station. You can listen for free at any time when you go to refnet.fm on your computer or when you download the free RefNet app. Well, tomorrow, Dr. Godfrey will address this question. What is required for different denominations to have unity?
Evangelicals recognize that there is a kind of minimalism to what their core values are. Evangelicals often want to ask, what are the minimal number of essential things that we have to believe to be faithful Protestant Christians and yet not reject other Protestant Christians?
We hope you'll join us Thursday for Renewing Your Mind.